Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's all you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, skipping away in the title, I'm here to talk of the stories of film. And I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the ingredients really that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast, they lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation just how hard it is to get a film off the ground. What you've happened upon here, though, is one of my occasional special episodes of the podcast where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their latest release and stroke or their body of work. And I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by someone I've wanted to talk to for years, Juan Antonio Bayona, who's co-written and directed the Oscar-nominated film Society of the Snow, that's currently enjoying, at the point this has been recorded, an enormous amount of success on Netflix. It's also been nominated for a pair of Academy Awards for Best Makeup and Hairstyling and also for Best International Feature Film. And I spoke to Juan Antonio a couple of weeks ago, actually, about the movie. So ahead of the Oscar nominations, we touch on one or two other films that he also has directed across his career, that namely The Orphanage, The Impossible and Monster Calls and Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Juan Antonio's English is quite brilliant, I must add. He was sitting next to someone who helped out with one or two little bits just when he couldn't find the right word. His English was a lot better than my Spanish, and I think you're going to find he's a really delightful and thoughtful man to talk to. So I think that's all the preamble. That's everything you need going into this. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play you a clip from the trailer of Society of the Snow, and then you'll hear my conversation with Juan Antonio Bayona the other side of this.
Sabemos dónde estamos.
Mírame los ojos.
¡Mírala!
todavía no se ve.
Y aunque pasen por encima nuestro, no van a ver.
¿Qué pasa cuando el mundo te abandona?
¡Ayuda!
Cuando no tenés ropa, te está congelando.
¿Dónde llegar hasta arriba?
Cuando no tenés comida.
That was a clip from Society of the Snow, the latest film from Juan Antonio Bayona. I'm absolutely thrilled that he's joining me for a Film Stories podcast special today. Hello, Juan Antonio. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you, Simon?
I'm all right. Thank you very much. And just as we were about to talk, I got a press release through, which is telling me that Society of the Snow is not only the most watched film on Netflix globally at the point we're recording, but this is the interesting, really interesting bit for me. In the UK too, it's a non-English language film that's in the number one spot. That, even if you hadn't made that film yourself, that sort of feels important, doesn't it?
We always love the appreciation from the audience, you know, but at the end you're doing a film for the audience. We've been very lucky in UK with my films. The Orphanage and The Impossible did very well.
Yeah.
Of course Jurassic World did very well also.
I've heard of that too.
but The Orphanage especially was a very small film and did very well in and The Impossible was very successful in UK too. So I really appreciate that from the audience here in UK, and it's fantastic to be in the number one spot right now.
I know why The Orphanage did so well in the UK. This isn't where this interview was going. It's because it's got a ZX Spectrum computer in it. I don't know if you had a ZX Spectrum growing up, but they were very big for us here in the UK. It's the only film I have ever seen with one of those in it. So put one of those in every one of your films. No, it's the point that it's a non-English language film that's been embraced by an audience. And as much as, you know, Parasite was supposed to open the floodgates, I'm not utterly sure that it did. And yet here it is as the number one movie. And so I did just want to touch and recognise that, because that feels like something to me. It is, though, interesting talking to a filmmaker when their film has been out for a couple of weeks, because I'm just curious, because this has been in your life a long time. How closely do you monitor this bit? Once the critics have had their bit and it's gone over to the audience, how close are you to the audience response to your film?
In this case, for example, I've been touring a lot on cinemas, introducing the film. I'm still doing it. So I'm going to be back in Spain on Friday night, and on Saturday I'm visiting a multiplex introducing the film. Sunday I'm doing another introduction in another cinema. I love the fact that the movie is doing fantastic. It's incredible. It's going very well in Netflix. But at the same time, the people is still watching the film in cinemas in Spain. So I really like to support also that. So it's great to be with this film, because the reactions from the audience are so good that it's kind of great after what it was to shoot a movie like this. It was so hard. It was difficult to accomplish. And every day on set, the weather conditions were so difficult. It took us a long shoot, 140 days. So it was very rewarding to see the film finally with an audience. The first time was in Venice Film Festival, where it played really well. And it's been like that all the time. So it's fantastic to enjoy a little bit now the success of the film with the audience, because it's been a very difficult movie to accomplish.
I will come back to the 100 days in a minute. I'm just curious, as you say, you're taking the film around the world and you're introducing these screens. Are there nuances in the cultural responses to the film, depending in what part of the world you're showing it? Has the reaction altered just in quite subtle little ways?
Yeah, you know, this is a movie that tries to talk about the story of this
people,
but it touches something that is universal.
Yes.
From the moment that I had to work in the story of 16 survivors, not counting the dead, it was 45 passengers, you really need to find what is the common denominator of these people. By doing so, because they were so different, you are finally touching what is the essence, and the essence is something universal. So when you play the movie in France, or you play the movie in Spain, or US, it has this universal appeal that talks to everybody, because that was part of the exercise to get to the essence of the story and to touch the most mythical or universal aspect of it.
You said when you were making A Monster Calls that you touched previously on themes in The Orphanage and The Impossible. The unifying factor was characters finding themselves in a very intense situation with death on the horizon. Yeah. And you seem to be visiting, well, clearly you're visiting that from a very, very different angle this time. What is it about that that fascinates you?
I think it's something that I don't know is something that it's there all the time. Probably I need to talk to my therapist to understand why it's in there. But it's something that I feel attracted to. Most of them are coming of age stories, even this one.
Absolutely, especially this one. Yeah,
especially this one, because they were so young. They were from 18 to 25.
Yeah,
there were people that it's not that they haven't seen the snow ever. It's some of them haven't seen a mountain.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So, and suddenly they found themselves in the middle of this geography, you know, and in that situation. And it's about growing up in a forceful way, you know? You are pushed to grow up in a very interesting way, and it takes the best of you. There's one line that I love from the survivors, Daniel Hernandez. He said, "We were never better person than in the mountain." So what I love is I like to address this darkness, but to find light in it. I'm not a pessimistic or a nihilist. Director, I'm quite the opposite. I hate cynicism.
I get that sense completely. That's why I asked the question. It's just like both you and your films aren't downbeat films to me. They're challenging, but they're not downbeat. And the thing you just said about coming of age, I mean, my colleague in his review of the film, and we both really liked it, his last line was, "It's a chilling coming of age story." That's his takeaway from it. These young adults who are having to make decisions that, with the best will in the world, when you're 20, you should be deciding what coat to wear.
It's to me, it's not strange the reactions, the success in the audience, because it talks in a very straightforward way to primal fears. It's like, you know, what are the primal fears? The fear to death, fear of starvation, fear of being abandoned, you know, and the characters face that journey. And by doing so, they have a journey of self-discovery, of where they know better themselves, where they get a much more complete image of who they are. This is why I love this line, "We were never better persons than in the mountain." That doesn't mean that they were good.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were more complete. Yeah. There's this moment, when you see the helicopter leaving, and one of them, Fito Strauch, who was in charge of the food, looks at the plane as he's leaving. That's something that he told me, with as a kind of like a little bit of nostalgia. So it's kind of like shocking, but very that a place where you have spent the worst days of your life, they at the same time allowed you to discover a much more complete image of yourself. And the intensity they live there, it's kind of like it creates this kind of attachment, you know. Yeah. When he's leaving, he's looking back as he was leaving kind of home, you know.
So you talked when you made The Impossible that you felt that you were the messenger of the people involved, that you threw yourself into the research of that. And this, I think, is pretty well known. This has been in your life for about 10, 11 years now.
Yeah.
And in the midst of conversations you've had, you've said about how you talk to the survivors and you shared some of their stories. But also I'm really fascinated that you talk to the people around the survivors as well.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what you got from them, because the survivor stories clearly are feeding directly into the film. But what did you get from the broader ecosystem?
Yeah, that first of all, and there's something that I love in your question, is that you mentioned that in The Impossible, I was the messenger.
Yeah, yeah.
I felt the same here. That's why I love all the time to mention Paulo Vierci's book. He wrote a fantastic book that was very helpful. And he was with me all the time on set, sitting by my side. He was a constant between me and the survivors. So every time I had a question, I will call them. He will call them, and we will get an immediate answer. So I have the impression that a lot of the potential of this film comes from them. So I always like to mention them, to mention Paulo Vierci, to mention the survivors, to mention the families of the deceased too, that were very supportive also. It gave me a very good look of what was to be there. And I was obsessed not with the fact, but with the spirit, with the mood.
Yeah.
I was more interested in creating a movie that felt like an emotional journey and not like the chronic of I didn't want to, for example, Alive is a great book. I think it's an extraordinary account of what happened in terms of the fact.
Yeah.
But in terms of the spirit, it lacks the potential of Society of the Snow, because Society of the Snow was written 35 years after the plane crash, and it has all the unanswered questions that these people had been doing themselves for almost 40 years, all the thoughts on trying to find the meaning of what happened. And that's what I was more interested in getting into, that psychological or spiritual layer. To me, it's more about the spirit and less about the fact. So talking to the survivors and the families of the deceased or the friends of the deceased was very important to get details that will allow me to get to those moments where you arrive to where you want to go by small gestures, looks between the actors or details in the story.
But at what point in that process? So I've got it that you optioned the book after 2012, I think it was, just after the Impossible. What point in the process are you certain that this is a film? What is your where does discovery become actual for you?
When we got the decision of telling the story through the eyes of Numa, because by doing so, you are touching immediately the spiritual layer. There is something metaphysical about having this voice coming from you don't know where, telling you the story. And at the same time, it gave me the arc of the narrative to give the survivors the possibility, the chance of give the dead a voice. And by doing so, keep them alive, bring them back to life. It was a beautiful way of saying thank you, because the dead were the ones that made their lives possible. And now, by telling their story, the survivors are bringing them back and making them feel alive for the audience. And that's a beautiful narrative.
Yeah.
It goes beyond the film, and it touches the essence of the film we're doing.
So how far into that 10-year process did you find that angle? I mean, was that very early on.
I sat down with Paulo Vierci for the first time to work in the script in 2016.
Yeah.
I think was already there, or we were playing with that idea early on, very early on. He wrote an article in 2000, in the early 2000s, he wrote an article called We, the Other Ones. And in that article, he was giving voice. He was telling the story through the voices of the dead. So it was, I never read that article, but I talk for hours and hours with Paulo Vierci, and that idea was already there. So it was something very early that from the very beginning, it gave us the need to shoot this film. We had this need to tell the story through this perspective, because by doing so, it has a totally different meaning.
But if directing a film is what, 1,000 decisions a day, we're told, directing a film when you're actually on the set, how does that change when you're also bearing the responsibility? I'm not in your shoes. I would imagine the responsibility of telling the story of the dead is even heavier than that of telling the story of the survivors. You say you can ring the survivors up and check something, but not so with the dead. How does that change the decision-making on set? Or was the work done at that point?
I had very long interviews with the survivors because I wanted to do it right. It was easier with the survivors because I was able to meet them. But with the dead, was very difficult. So what I interview their friends or their families and the survivors a lot. The survivors were quite shocked that my first questions when I sat down with them were about dead people because they are so used to tell their story. They start to talk. As soon as you start to talk to them, they will start to talk about themselves. And I was asking them questions about other people, you know? So they were pretty shocked about it, you know? But the truth is that I needed to get a very good idea of the personalities of them, of the dead also. So I interviewed all the people who was alive in nowadays that were in contact with them.
Yeah. So when you get this to the set, I'm curious how this actually tests you as a filmmaker, because I don't think you've joined the 100 Club before. I think this is your first film that's shot for more than 100 days. I don't think anyone does the 100 Club.
No, The Impossible was 120. A Monster Course was 116.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And is that something you build in that you want a long physical production of the film, or is that out of necessity?
Yeah, because it creates something. You know, when you do a film, you create a family. And if the journey is longer, the emotions in the screen are higher, you know, are more intense, are more truthful. You can tell how the friendship and the camaraderie in the film was happening also on set, you know, and we had time to tell the story and at the same time to explore the story, to make ourselves the same kind of questions the survivors were making themselves in Pablo Vierce's book. So by doing so, you need time. There's something that is very difficult to capture in the performance, which is all the invisible things.
Yeah,
like the relationships between them, the way they trust each other, the sense of camaraderie and friendship. It's very hard to capture with a camera, so you really need to create it. You really need to make that work. You need to really make it happen, and that happens with time. You know,
it's fascinating because it sounds to me like the most expensive film you made, Jurassic World, was the one where you had one of the fewest amounts of time on set. Then that when you're doing when you're generating the films yourself, you can build in that you require this to be able to get it done. You seize that control.
It's always a priority to me the amount of shooting days. When we produce a film, Jurassic World was more like a directors for hire, you know?
Yeah, I get that.
I was working for them at the service of their film. And it was a very different structure, you know, where I didn't have that much, I didn't have control. I didn't say much about that, you know, it felt very industrial, you know. Quite the opposite when I shoot films in Spain, then Possible was a Spanish, Monster Call was a Spanish film, and this one is also a Spanish film. I work with my production partners and we design a schedule where we do the best of our plan, and I like to spend time on set, you know. So there are moments there that you just basically move the numbers in a different way to make that happen, to make that possible.
That's really, and the only reason I come back to that two or three times is you're the only director I've interviewed in a long time who said that, who is pushing for the extra time. And it does feel a little bit against the grain.
But that's a dream. I mean, if you're
I get it.
Producing a film, you want the time to be able to explore with the actors, allowing them to have the space to be creative on set. You know, I work very hard the preparation of a film, very hard. I do all the storyboards. I To me, the pre-production is probably the most important aspect in the making of a film. But then you do the film in the shoot. And the first time you see the actors in front of a camera, you have the chance to react to that. And all the decisions that you take that day, even though they suppose 180 switch of what you plan, are the result of all the things you have thought until that moment, you know? So I really like to improvise on set, but it's the good, that kind of good improvisation that is the result of a lot of hard work that I've done before getting on set. You understand?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, going back to the 100 days and you said earlier in this conversation that it was, the conditions were on the taxing side, I think. And it's a long time since I felt so small watching a film. Mm-hmm. You know, that you take very, very, I mean, you know this, but very slow shots that show me the overview of the situation, and you never fail to remind me of that. What was it like in the moment of all of that? Because presumably you were, you say it was taxing, presumably you were in there, you know, you're not faking a lot of it.
But when you are in the mountain and when you are in the Andes, you feel like that. You feel that small, you know. But it's in the interior scenes inside the plane where you enhance the personalities. You know, it's kind of interesting that the claustrophobia is felt outside.
That's really interesting.
And it's in the inside of the plane where you have a sense of intimacy, where friendship and the other ones become everything. And in that sense, it feels a much more secure place, that claustrophobic location, the fuselage, than the outside that feels more. You can feel more anguish in the outside.
And so, in the midst, I mean, once you've locked the cut of the film, you've talked about how you showed it to the survivors and you got their input at that stage and their response at that stage. Again, I guess I'm curious. The survivors clearly there and in the midst of it. But what about the families? What about the people in that broader ecosystem watching it? What kind of responses were you getting off them?
It's been like a whole different movie.
Yeah,
a very emotional one too.
Yeah,
because we always talk during the pre-production and the shoot to these people in two different groups. We always had meetings with the survivors, and then we had meetings with the families.
Interesting.
But always separately, you know, because somehow they work like that. It's not that they have a bad relation, because actually some of them are related to each other. Like some of the survivors are families with the families of the deceased, so they have strong connections. But it's true that there was like a barrier in between them. Sometimes it's kind of like an auto impose, you can say that. Auto impose, it's an imposition that they do themselves. It's kind of like barrier of silence, you know, where they don't talk about what happened, and that was there for. That's been there for more than 50 years. Lots of people not talking about it. And sometimes that makes it even harder. I can see that in the sons and the grandsons of the survivors. They wanted to know more about the story, but they didn't talk that much. Or they didn't know much about what happened, because even the survivors were not telling them. So the moment we showed them the film for the first time, there was one of them, Gustavo Cervino, who decided to put everybody in the same room and stop treating them separately. So we found ourselves 5 days before the world premiere in Venice, doing a screening in Uruguay, in Montevideo, with 360 people, all related to in that plane, all families from the people who was in that plane, dead and survivors together for the first time. We were super scared because
it's that sounds terrifying film.
And of course most of them were very scared, but there was a huge applause at the end. There was it was very emotional. People hugging each other. People who didn't talk about what happened in 50 years talking about it. I remember like Adolfo Strauch, one of the survivors, his son told me that after watching the film, they spent 3 days, all the family gathering together with Adolfo, talking about it. They did like 3 days in a row, like where they did a great lunch, where suddenly Adolfo was talking about what happened, and all the families knew about what happened in the plane, because they didn't talk to them, and the same with the survivors and the families of the disease. Suddenly, the last time I was in Montevideo, I went to an event from the families of the deceased, and the survivors were there and they were together. So I think this film has kind of helped them to break this kind of like barrier, invisible barrier that they had in between them.
And your conversation with them, it sounds like it hasn't stopped just because the film's finished.
But we talk.
See, that's really important, isn't it? That's,
we talk all the time and we are in contact with them. It's, you know, we created a very strong relation with the survivors and also with the families of the dead. So it's like a family, you know. And the same with the actors. I just got a video from Simon, who's playing Coche, Coche Inciarte. Coche died 5 months ago, 6 months ago, and he just texts me a video where he surprised his widow. In a dinner, and it's all the family of Coche together, and the actor is surprising his widow, and they are super happy and celebrating Coche's life together. And we finished the shoot a year ago, and the actors are still in contact with them.
So I was hugely affected by Monster Calls, which was my favorite film of that particular year. But in the nicest sense, it's not a film I can watch very often. You know, I'm at the point now where I have to have like some.
You don't want to be exposed to those things.
It's well, I sort of do and I sort of don't. But I do wonder, when you've made a film like that, that didn't, I mean, in the case of that one, it didn't set the box office alight, if memory serves. I mean, it found an audience here in the UK, I remember. But I mean, you've got an instance there where you've had 360 people in a room and you're getting the response instantly. Do you feel the response of films like A Monster Calls and, you know, the impact all these years later? Are these films that people come and talk to you about? Because if I start talking to you about it, I'm just going to break down.
No, what I can tell you is that from my experience, I found a lot of people thanking me for doing that film because they went through a similar situation.
Yeah, I'll thank you for making it, if that's all right. Yeah.
And the movie has helped them. Well, that's what the movie is about, is to understand and to cope with those feelings. And people who go through those feelings is the people that you will expect that they don't want to see the film because they don't want to be there anymore. And quite the opposite is the people who comes to you and say thank you because they were able to cope with what they went through better by watching the film.
Yeah, it kind of, for me, it stared death in the face and told me not to be so scared of it a little bit.
Taboos, you know, we live in
absolutely
society right now that doesn't face the uncertainty of life, that everything can change in a second, as you can see in this film. They were spending a very nice weekend, and then everything changed in a second, and they had to grow up by force and very quickly, you know, like I think it's one of the big problems in the society that we live right now.
Yeah, I agree.
We don't want to feel pain. Everything is done to be consumed quick and fast and with no pain, you know? So we are not prepared when that things happens, and that thing is going to happen. There's a moment that you're going to be there, you know?
And in Society of the Snow, I think that's why it's so important that everyone is named. Which sounds like you've got a huge cast for that. I don't know if you've ever had a bigger cast, but everybody is named to, from what I could see. Everyone has something.
The names were changed in previous versions because they were not allowed to use them. And I found myself, like, for some of the families, especially the families of the dead, was very hard not to see the names of their people, especially for the grandchild, the nieces and nephews of the dead. Not like watching a film where they see the names of their families change was very hard to, they found it very hard to cope with it, you know. So for me, it was also very important, because from the moment you have a name on the screen, you have a reality.
Yes, incredible. I mean, we're pretty much out of time, sadly. I could talk to you for a very, very long time. I'm just curious. So if you started researching this around the time of The Impossible, and it's taken, 10, 11 years to get this far, what did you start researching around the time you were making A Monster Calls that we're likely to see next?
I have some things there right now I'm thinking about now. There is already... It was already out. I'm preparing a film on the Spanish Civil War that is based upon one of the best books ever published on the subject. It's called A Sangre y Fuego, in Blood and Fire. And it's a book written in 1937 that is considered to be probably the best book on the Spanish Civil War. It's a massive project. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it, you know, because it needs to be shot in Spanish. But it's something that I'm working on at the moment.
So there was a point where I think it was Clint Eastwood when he was making Unforgiven. And I was only a kid when I was reading the interview. And he said that he found the story and then had to wait 10 years to tell it because he, as a filmmaker, wasn't in that position to tell it. I wonder if you felt that a little bit with Society of the Snow and feeling that a little bit with the story you've got next.
I read the same. It's very interesting. I read the same from Steven Spielberg. He mentioned that shooting The Color Purple helped him to make Schindler's List better, which I understand why he's saying that, and I can apply that to me. I think that to shoot The Impossible was a very good training to me to shoot Society of the Snow, and I'm very proud of both films.
Yes.
But you can tell that Society of the Snow has a reach that it's kind of touches something that feels more complex.
Yeah.
The Impossible is about a kid. It's about this family, but you have this kid in the center who does what he has taught. And then he gets the recognition, you know. There's this beautiful last scene between mother and son where they say, "I love you," in the plane, you know, when they are leaving Thailand. But in this film, you have a character in the center who does what is considered to be the right thing, and he doesn't get the recognition. And by doing so, that feels a lot more complex and touches humanity from a complexity that makes it more, even more interesting somehow.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, Society of the Snow is has done one step forward in terms of the complexity of what means to be alive, you know, what means to be human. And in that sense, I think The Impossible was a good preparation for this one.
Juan Antonio Bayona, this has been an absolute thrill talking to you. Thank you so much for your time, and huge congratulations on your film as well. More ZX Spectrums in your next films, though.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Thank you.
And that was my conversation with the wonderful Juan Antonio Bayona, the Oscar-nominated Juan Antonio Bayona, for Society of the Snow, which is available to watch on Netflix now. There's a very, very brief mention in there, you might have noticed, of Alive, which covers the same story, but in a very different way to Society of the Snow. Alive was filmed by Frank Marshall in the early 1990s, so just to clear that up. But that, That aside, I think we're pretty much through here. We've got to the end of this episode of Film Stories, and I don't want to outstay my welcome any further. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for your support. If you want more of my warblings, I'm on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew. Film Stories is found there at Film Stories. We're on Facebook.com/Film Stories Online, YouTube.com/Film Stories, and if you go to filmstories.co.uk, that is our website, updated every weekday with movie, games, TV, news, reviews, features, mischief, mayhem, trouble, all that sort of thing, really. We try really hard to be an entertainment website that doesn't do clickbait, which means the algorithms absolutely hate us. So any support you can give us there is much, much appreciated. And if you want to support us with a bit of money, go to patreon.com/Simon Brew. You get the podcast early and ad-free. And then our print magazines are for sale at store.filmstories.co.uk. But I think that's enough. I will leave you in peace now. I'm off to watch another bunch more films because I've got the next episode to write. Take care. Look after yourselves. I will be back soon with some more film stories. Bye-bye.